Time to have another chat with State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy for our Tacky Talk podcast. Hey, Tacky, how are you today?
Hey, good morning, Joe, on this very sticky and sort of kind of warm Wednesday morning.
Yes, we're launching right into summer on cue here. It's going to be like 90 degrees, look out. Here we go.
We had some torrential rainstorms. As I talked about last week, we had that weird drizzle kind of coolish graduation for North and for Quincy High. And then I've been out and about to a lot of events the last, actually, since May forward. I think I've been out doing something. I think about 10 consecutive days at a time, it feels like. I think some actually were 10 consecutive days at a time. And we're hitting that hard part of the season where the State House public hearings come full gear, as well as advocacy days. For example, I got an email this morning regarding one of my bills on allowing seniors in public subsidized housing to keep their pets with them by law, obviously within some regulations of being reasonable. And the Humane Society is looking to do an advocacy day, which I am going to be participating in at some point this month. So, and that just popped up this morning for, I believe, the 24th. Today's the 18th. So, these things are now really coming in hard and fast about things not just in my bills, for which is I use the example, but other people's important issues, and just trying to keep up at this point. I can't do it all. I do send staff out, whether it's a virtual meeting or a human in-person meeting, to cover for me. But and we are at that stage where it is very active. Like Law Day was last week, QCAP was last week. Speaker Marano received two awards in one day, one at Law Day and one with QCAP. Congratulations to Ron on well-deserved achievements by two organizations in the same day, one in the morning and one at night. So this is kind of the lifestyle we've moved into this time of year. Tonight is Work Inc.'s annual award meeting. I'm a board member there still. And I have a formal session today, and I'm trying to get through like day-to-day stuff. I'm into the trying to get to the supermarket on like an after, like late morning between like 11 and 1, just do the 30-minute whiz through. I'm at that stage. I'm like, last week I forgot my dry cleaning. I was like, hey, I forgot it was still there. I had to go like, oh, I look at the wall. I'm like, oh, dry clean. I better get my dry cleaning. I'm out of suits. Explains how good my drawer, my closet's out of suits. So yeah, no, real life and work life is really getting to be compounded.
This is the time of year when everybody tries to cram everything in before the end of the school year. Matter of fact, today is the last day of school here in Quincy.
Is it?
Yes, it is.
When was the last day of school today? I actually planned my commutes around school. I live near Beach Windows School, as you may be aware, down Fennel Street, and Central's on the other side on Hancock. And of course, got the Walton School up on Beale Street. So actually, and then North is way on the other end, going to the Ponset. So big surprise, guys. I actually do plan my driving route around the school hours. So school ending is welcome from my standpoint, given the fact that I do have not consistent hours and travel. And I actually do plan around when school is in and when school gets out and which road I'm going to take.
Well, there you go. Now you can plan for no more school for a couple of months.
Yeah, freedom to drive during certain times of day.
It was fun to see you at the Flag Day parade. The weather held off for that, thankfully.
Yeah, as promised, raincoat and hat. If you all were wondering, I did follow through on that with an umbrella in my pocket, sneakers, my black sneakers, and it was an incredibly wonderful parade. I have to give a ton of credit to the mayor and the city departments, as well as all the people who showed up in the weather. Obviously, the biggest crowd was at Veterans Stadium on the corner of Southern Artery and Hancock, and and all the people who, came out and worked on these floats and worked, as the band and wore the costumes. It was a great celebration of Quincy's 400 years. And people forget I'm old enough that I know what Child Ward is. I spent a lot of time there as a kid. And the memories it holds regarding big parts of my life. But I mean, celebrating places like Howard Johnson and Woolsworth, right? Two places that, one, I We don't remember because Wollaston Station was already built because the original Howard Johnson was at Wollaston Station. But I remember being at Howard Johnson's at other locations as a kid. The Wharf counter is legendary. If you had to go buy your school supplies down at Paperama, you would definitely have to go by the Wharf counter to buy school supplies. So, of course, they had like the old downtown Remix and Sears and, of course, the Bargain Center. That display, as well as the historical displays of the Adams houses and the importance of scouting and and just incredible marching bands. I really can't speak enough how good it was. So definitely watch it on QATV. It's replaying on whatever schedule Joe is working under. And I think there's a YouTube with this as well, if in case you didn't catch it in person. And yes, we got extremely lucky. The morning was getting me nervous, and the weather reports like it's going to clear by the evening. But again, it is the weather report, and we are New England, so anything can still happen.
Yeah, thankfully it did clear out enough anyway. The fireworks were pretty low, but they went off anyway.
Yeah, I went straight home from the end of the parade because I live 15-minute or less walk, depending on how quickly I walk, back to my house. And me and my mom sat on the front steps and watched the fireworks. I live on the other side of Black's Creek Marsh. I can get a clear view of Patch and Field. With the trees, I can't see over the trees, obviously. And even low, we had a beautiful view of it, what was it, 850-ish, for about a 20-minute display. And it's, I think, one of the biggest and longest displays the city's ever done.
Yeah, I would agree because I've been to a lot of parades, let me tell you. And this was by far the biggest and best for sure.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. And also, much thanks to Boston. I'm sorry, state troopers coming in with their horses. And of course, the Quincy police being a high presence given the circumstances on Saturday. Saturday was a very busy day on so many levels.
Indeed, indeed, both locally and nationally, for sure. A lot going on, good and bad.
And regretfully, yes. Unfortunately, violence against elected officials is not unheard of in the United States, but extraordinarily rare. It's extraordinarily rare. We're not some banana republic where, people are killed regularly. I mean, you have that Colombian federal senator that was shot about a week ago, and I had mentioned before that in Japan, Mexico, he had, I think up to 45 plus murders of candidates and elected officials, and then the president of Korea was stabbed in the neck in assassination attempt last year. And of course, former Prime Minister Abe was killed by a makeshift weapon, I think more than 2 years ago now. And it's open game for elected officials. And generally in America, this is a fairly safe country. And we're people pretty respectful overall, but it's still shaking when you have anyone, any elected official, murdered, especially. One guy with a list of 45 folks and was basically knocking on doors to find out somebody was home. This was clearly premeditated. It appears perhaps it is a anti-abortion individual, but until the police go through all the materials, and he himself may or may not speak about it regarding his actual motivations. But my obviously our hearts go out to the to the people of Minnesota, and no one should have to face this kind of stuff. And
Yeah.
it's not lost on me that Quincy police presence was significantly higher on Saturday than I'm normally used to.
Have you ever felt threatened yourself, Tacky?
I mean, Asian racism didn't help. I mean,
Oh, right. Yeah.
didn't have that like 2 year people 2 year period where people considered us open games. The haters decided it was a okay to take puck shots at us. So, but it's not unusual. I mean, people, as I remind people, I grew up in a different decade in Quincy, and bullying and the opportunity to kick the crap out of somebody who looks different was not exactly a new experience. So, not like I'm immune to this stuff. I'm not, but it's something that's more of a way of life in my mentality than it is to other people, where I've had to look over my shoulder in the city as a kid more times than I wanted to admit. That other people never had to feel that way. You have that element that's a little bit different with me than other electeds. And then whether or not you me being concerned about being assaulted or something like that. No, I mean, again, I'm used to looking over my shoulder regardless. Do I want to get attacked as single elected? No. Have I been threatened, like strange emails and stuff? Yeah, we send those to the state police. If this was 30 years ago, I would just brush it off as a joke or nonsense. But we live in an era that you send any kind of document or phone call up to us that appears even potentially threatening. The state police now wants it. I remember a time when, bomb threats were kind of like, oh, hum at the state house. So it was like one every week minimum. But until, the threat was verified, they didn't bother telling us. Nowadays, it's much more common. And those who visit state house knows there are actually no protections for us. We're against the street, the building. It's not like it's hard to get to. Other state houses, especially the newest ones, have about a 1,500-foot barrier with a difficulty even trying to ram it by driving through the area. It's actually not easy to directly drive into a state house around the country. We're actually one of the exceptions. And those who aren't aware, I mean, state officials do not receive any kind of protection, and our federal delegation does not as well. I mean, it's not like we are assigned any kind of law enforcement, and that includes the federal delegation, unless you're in like high leadership in the federal delegation. And, when we had the insurrection in January 6th, the state police had us on a conference call, informing us of higher security protocols at the state house. But also that if something happens to us at home, call your local cops. We're not, they don't have the capacity to be there. They're not going to be there. So, even after the insurrection, I didn't call Quincy Police and say, hey, I'd like to have a detail up in front of my house. I didn't do that.
Yeah, I think the governor has some sort of security. Does she not?
The governor, the attorney general in particular, has a security detail. You
Okay,
need
yeah.
district attorneys have security details, if they want to use it, which is also another different conversation. But they have the capacity for security detail if they need one. And
Okay.
then the tr state auditor has a security detail, which I thought was a little peculiar. Never seen that. The Secretary of State, I believe, is entitled, but never does, and neither is the Treasurer.
Okay.
Seen either one use security detail. Or perhaps they have in the past, but it was an isolated situation, not a everyday occurrence.
Right.
Minimum, the governor and the attorney general get security. The rest of us aren't.
Sure, and maybe Lieutenant Governor, maybe too.
The LG does. I'm sorry. You're right.
Yeah.
The LG.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. Just curious. Just interesting. Can I get back to your the senior housing issue? Are
Sure.
seniors allowed to have pets in public housing?
It's a case-by-case basis from the housing authority.
Oh, okay.
Just want to give everyone the right to have their pet. Again, within regulations. I mean,
Okay.
within. So I think people agree that you have a well-behaved pet that doesn't cause any problems. And, it's important to seniors because as human beings, most of us really need to care for someone or something, whether it be, human being or a pet. And some people care about their hobbies, but people need to care, and it's an essential part of being alive and keeping us alive that you have purpose. And I think, purpose means different things to different people. It really
Right.
does. And it's those that purpose in life that keeps us living, keep us driven to continue to get day to day. As I like to say, I don't live for today. I try to live to get to tomorrow.
Yeah. Do you know what the policy is in Quincy?
I don't remember. It's been a while.
Yeah.
Trying to remember. I remember a long time ago, back when I worked in Morrissey's office, there was a pet problem, which they did not allow to have pets at Quincy Housing Authority. But that we're talking about back in the Morrissey days, well
Okay.
past 20 years now. And it was a big controversy. I can't speak to the policy today. I believe you can have pets today. And I believe, I'm not sure. You have to talk to Jim Morales. I could tell I'm kind of dating myself by remembering there was one still policy, but that was a very long time ago.
Okay. All right. Yeah. It's just I should know that too, but I don't, but I'll find out.
Yeah, I let me know. It's not a conversation I've had with him. Although I did find out, much to my surprise, that the Quincy Housing Authority is going to be putting up or attempting to. There's no finalization of this. 94 new senior housing units at O'Brien Towers and Walston Center.
Yes.
As representative from Walston, they've lived here pretty much my entire life in Wollaston. I didn't even know there was a public meeting, nor did I know there was a plan. I didn't even receive like a notice or anything from anybody, but even just as a resident, much less sitting elected.
Oh, okay. At O'Brien Towers?
I'm sorry, Tobin.
Okay.
My mistake. Tobin Towers. So I didn't receive a notice. I had no clue what was going on. It's kind of funny because this isn't actually just an elected issue, but I'm a resident that's one. I mean, I don't think I'm inside it. I'm not inside a 2,000-foot buffer zone regarding required notification. But given the walls and centers, you know, a big part of everyone living within like a mile of it, you know, 2 miles, I mean, you figure it'd be more notice, you know, to the residents, but there was none.
Mr. Morathis mentioned that to me a little bit back. So it's Clay Street, right? Kind of in back of CVS, basically, right?
Yeah, that's what they're looking at. So there's enough space. Of course, the problem is that it's a bowl.
Yes. Yeah, they're well aware of the water issues there. Yeah, it's a problem.
Yeah, Chuck Phelan once told me that it was like an ice skating rink
Yeah.
kind of park back there when he was a
I saw some
child.
pictures, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, it's almost like a natural spring of some form because the water table is so high that it's not like a natural spring, like it's not like a brook under there, but it's just such a high water table. It just naturally pulls the surface and forms kind of weird natural spring that's not a natural spring.
Right. Yeah, that needs to be mitigated for sure. So, I mean, even the train station across the street, used to flood before the new station was built.
Actually, it was one of the biggest impediments to having Wollaston Station constructed was the fact they couldn't figure out how to manage the water issue. Again, it's also in a bowl.
Right.
And you put an elevator in to be ADA compliant. Wollaston Station was the last station in the system to be ADA compliant. And literally the reason was the elevator needs to be below ground level because
Yep.
that's where the elevator starts.
Right.
So that's where the base and mechanics are. But because of the flooding issue, they couldn't figure out how to do that without basically shutting the elevator, electrocuting people or whatever. So there's actually a storage, if I remember correctly, there's an actual storage plus pumping at Wollaston Station. Obviously, the power goes out. I mean, they have emergency power for a little bit, but I mean, you know, the whole system shuts down anyway. But you know, I as a kid and as an adult, you know, I've been in situations where we had to pass by Wollaston to go to Quincy Center because we couldn't get out of Wollaston because of super, super heavy rains.
Yes. Yep.
And you know, more than one time, I remember them kind of trying to sweep it out the drain, but the drain was full. Because it couldn't actually get out. So that actually is the reason why Wollaston Station took the longest to be ADA compliant. And we can think 70s style construction, cheap and fast.
Right. No, exactly. Oh, the water used to cascade down those stairs like a waterfall.
Yeah, and it's a lake at the bottom. So, but no, it's you can blame cheap 70s construction. I mean, those stations were built in the 70s, fast and low value. And you know, as we talked about MBTA problems. The whole system's riddled with the fact since they're built in different decades, with different standards and different costs associated with it, which means some places were done super duper cheap. You know, they found structural, they keep finding structural and inconsistencies in engineering, with Philip Ng at the MBTA, who's the general manager, who is actually an engineer by profession before doing management work, you know, is really, really challenged. I think people don't understand it. This is a nasty jigsaw puzzle built over many different decades, done on the cheap in many places. And as a result, trying to get a uniform looking safety standard and even equipment standard across the T is very costly and an engineering nightmare.
Right, yeah. Seeing as we're on the topic, let's talk about the supplemental budget that will funnel a lot of money to the MBTA.
Yeah, but at least $300 from the so-called Mariners tax surplus money is going to go to the MBTA. The money for the surplus on the Mariners tax still can only go to education and transportation purposes. And given the crisis of the T's structural deficit, which has been kicked down the can for so long that it's finally no further to kick, you know, the surplus money and in the budget. We've baked into the Mariners tax, you know, actually a good portion of the Mariners tax into the MBTA now.
Yes, 2/3, I think, for the House bill. I think the Senate is a little less.
Yeah, Senate's a little bit different because the Senate is obviously smaller, but they also have less senators directly impacted MBTA in the Greater Rail system if we don't count the commuter rail, because Greater Boston has actually less senators than than outside Greater Boston, believe it or not.
Hmm.
Over a time when there was actually 20% of the Senate was Boston senators when I first started working there. So, how quickly things have changed in the Senate, where I think they're just at 10% of the Senate, maybe 15%. I mean, it's like, I think, six now in the Senate, but really Boston senators. So, I mean, Senate political strength is very different from the House in Boston, where I think the Boston delegation, I remember when I first started working in the State House many moons ago, like 35, I believe. Now they're about 23, give or take. Yeah, give or take. Give or take. I have to look at the list again, but I believe it's like 23. I have to look. But I mean, things, this is the nature of demographics, and the majority of the population now lives outside the city of Boston. So, but yeah, those of us in the Greater Boston MBTA area obviously advocate for the MBTA. Those outside the MBTA service area isn't very interested in the MBTA. This is politics 101.
Although it could go to regional transit agencies too, right?
We do put money to transit agencies, but not in the same size as the MBTA.
Sure, of course, yeah.
And regional transit is more decentralized. People talk about regional transit agency like it's one entity. It's not. They have specific, sometimes have their own regional transit. Brockton comes to mind. And then you look at some other communities in Western Mass, where there's a coalition of local governments that maintain regional transit agents together, because you go to places like the Berkshire. It's all far, it's all so far apart.
Just geographically, right? It needs to be done that way in order to be efficient.
Yeah, and those of us in the Greater Boston area is supportive of regional transportation, because we do understand, the value of it. Since we live in regional transportation ourselves, the economic and societal benefits regarding public transit. So, not surprising, those of us in the Greater Boston area are very understanding of the issues of regional transit, and we're very supportive of regional transit outside of our constituencies.
Sure.
So, yeah, a good portion of money goes to that as well, and also the highway stuff. And then where we didn't, I don't, we didn't use this to backfill potential federal losses on funds. We did it did in peace and other deficiency supplemental budget, which is bill paying, which they released some money early out of conference committee, some small parts of education funds that has reached the end in terms of we don't have to do any migrant money at the moment, because we're actually closing the migrant center actually this month, I believe, in Quincy. I think there'll be no welcome centers left in the state, and the emergency shelter program is starting to stabilize right now, and the crisis is past for the moment. I do think that we're not out of the woods. I do think that as the economy becomes more rocky, and people may be losing their jobs. I know there'd be the level foreclosure crisis 08 to 2011, essentially. But I do think there's gonna be a lot more stress on households, and the emergency shelter system is the temporary solution as people try to figure out what to do with housing next.
Yeah, there's a troubling report just today from the Greater Boston Food Bank about food insecurity increasing dramatically over the past, say, 5 or 6 years. Up to like 37% now of state households experience food insecurity. So that's concerning.
Yeah, we talked about that during COVID too. I mean, people didn't even, the majority of Americans didn't have $2,000 in savings in their bank accounts. And then, that's, because people may agree or disagree with the government emergency handouts, for lack of a better term, where they just handed us cash. Many parts of the country that paid someone's rent for probably 3 months in some instances. So again, cost of living, different parts of the country is different on how money's managed. But we're also aware of income disparity, and savings rates are a reflection of that. And saving rates are going down slowly but steadily as people continue to have to pay for things. And inflation is not a magical thing that comes down instantly. It takes months for it to impact you on Main Street and me on Main Street, from the macro data. And as we've seen, inflation has gone down, but the math is really funky on how it's gone down. Again, we talked about this all the time now for literally like 2 months. Gasoline prices are not going down.
No, they're going up actually because price of oil has gone up now.
Yeah, because of the situation in the Middle East. But when oil was under $60 a barrel, it should have been closer to $2.30, and it wasn't.
No, it's over $3, and even in our area, I've seen.
Yeah, I mean, very confused, because you look at the last CPI data, energy is the one that went down the most.
Yeah.
Ignore eggs was a whole thing, but I mean,
Yeah.
energy was the thing driving down inflation. You look at the rest of the costs, they weren't exactly, household goods weren't exactly driving down inflation. It was really just one segment of the CPI calculation.
Yeah, I have. I mean, do you think the conflict in the Middle East is somewhat to blame?
Well, I mean, there's a global problem, right? I mean, as the president correctly points out, I mean, there's wars breaking out everywhere, civil wars as well as cross-border wars, and it's not just limited to the Middle East and Europe, but there's, there's stuff going on in Africa, Myanmar
Hmm.
in the midst of the civil war. You've got conflicts actually going off all over the place, or various type of domestic problems as well, and changing spheres of influence. So I mean, the Middle East is still driving a lot of it. People have already forgotten that things coming out of the Suez, still has been under Houthi attack nonstop for literally like 6 months plus now. And between the US, the UK, and Israelis, kind of keep picking off these guys, shooting essentially missiles and bazookas and whatever. I mean, they're just shooting stuff at ships. Oddly, not the Russian ones, but everyone else. It is a big, it's a big, big problem regarding shipping costs and also transported shipping. If people don't want to go that direction and take the longer route, which again is bad for carbon footprint, well as higher insurance costs, and the Reds and the Strait of Hormuz, and not the Red Sea, but the great, my geography is bad. But I mean, 20-25% of all oil has to pass Strait of Hormuz, which the Iranians have historically shot at ships, and people forgot they mined it. We're just talking before the show started. I mean, I'm old enough to remember Ronald Reagan, flying US flag ships into the Strait of Hormuz for a battle with a battalion to get mine sweeping out. And you take a shot at anybody's ship, the US was going to retaliate
Yeah.
and help cool tensions down a little bit in the area. And if you look at the Middle Eastern conflict, I was talking to a friend about this over dinner last week. It is really a conversation of like 4 years. It's not a conversation about the last 3 months. If you really, you have to think about this, and someone's going to be writing a book at this at some point because there's too many moving parts. A lot of stuff was going on even before the October 8th massacre. There was a lot of stuff happening in the background. It all came to a head really, in the last 2 years, but especially in the last 6 months in the Middle Eastern power struggle shift. So for example, I mean, we talked about the fall of Syria sometime back regarding the Assad regime, where him and his father were basically murdering like a third of the country at one point. I mean, it's just terrible human beings by far and none. And but people, even before that, people would realize that the Russians had withdrawn from Syria because of the Ukrainian war. Hence, the Assad regime lost the war. And basically, Iran funds the Assad regime because they need water access to a different area. They use Syria as the other access area to get to the Mediterranean. And also, when I was a kid, and it's true, Syria, the barren areas of Syria were, terrorist training grounds. I mean, Clinton sent cruise missiles into those areas to take them out. Obama sent them in to take them out. Reagan sent them in to take them out. I mean, Syria is one of those places where the U.S. will target terrorist camps on the backside where nobody's living there, try to find and just hit them. With cruise missiles and today's drones. The US has a small presence there, and you got the Kurdish problem. I mean, Syria is a really horrible what happens to the people of Syria by that government. But people forget the Iranians are the ones supporting them. The Iranians support Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, which destabilizes Lebanese government because Hezbollah is not the government of Lebanon. I mean, it's a parliamentary system with a paramilitary political group as part elected. But they are not the government. And then you have like Hamas, which is funded by a lot of different groups, by Iran as a major backer, and the Houthis are a major backer. And people forgot. I mean, Iran-Iraq War, one of the reasons during the Cold War, the U.S. actually backed Saddam Hussein was because we're trying to stabilize the region against Iran, which was trying to conquer Iraq. People forget this stuff very quickly. And, of course, then we Saddam Hussein was a bad pick after the fact. And, George W. Bush, took him out. But then you had a regional instability where we now were occupying Iraq for like 20 odd years.
Right.
So, I
Yeah,
mean,
there's power vacuum, right? Yeah.
but this is the problem anytime in military conflicts, people oversimplify the fact that you could just, kill off a leader, right? The problem, of course, is that, now you have this stabilization, and do you really want to be running country? Or do you want a neighboring country to invade and probably commit some level of genocide? I mean, let's be
Exactly. Yeah.
this was like, I was watching a documentary about what was a short documentary regarding why Nagasaki and Hiroshima was bombed during World War II and why Tokyo wasn't. It was a very simple answer. If you destroy the entire Japanese government, who do you negotiate peace with?
It's exactly. It was more of a bargaining chip, sad to say. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a threat. We unfortunately killed millions and millions of people, but do send a clear message to leadership that, we can't. So, this is a problem is some of these, as a reminder folks, Hamas is a government, not just a terrorist group. They are the government of Gaza. They are their political leaders. And obviously the Israelis been picking off those guys because clearly they don't want to behave like civilized humans, like everyone else does regarding I don't know, behaving like a government that we think you should be. And Hezbollah, again, is a paramilitary group. They knocked their heads off too in terms of operations. But I mean, that's one thing. But you take out Iran's leadership team, which is 89 million people living there, and it's really complicated economy because they're an oil-based economy. They don't really have a larger, like, modern economy that we live in. And they live on basically subsidy systems because of the oil money. They can live on subsidies. You destabilize that, there's 89 million people, and a civil war is going to break out.
Right. Yeah, exactly. We'd like to talk about the economy on this podcast and the Fed's meeting today, actually, Tacky.
Yeah, I don't expect the Federal Reserve to do anything. I expect them to maintain rates. I think the question is how much the Fed's going to talk about the future forecast based on past data. We talked about this last time. Tariffs don't impact right away. There was a huge trade deficit in the first quarter, simply because people were trying to get all their stuff into the country to maximize their warehouse storage before tariffs hit. Those who didn't get into the country in time when tariffs hit, there was a massive amount of tariffs paid in the month of April. Not surprising. So, big businesses are trying to, draw down inventory that are tariff, not a lot of tariffs, but small businesses are the ones who are going to suffer, who do not have mass inventory and are going to have to work on higher costs and change the business model. And I do expect that if this continues, Main Street businesses are going to be most severely and badly hurt and going to have the hardest time to maintain this. Any type of food insecurity, right? A lot of these small businesses, also restaurants and for small food suppliers, especially goods, and the prices go up more, they're not going to be able to sustain themselves. And
Right. Yeah,
that's
it's
a problem.
important to keep an eye on the unemployment figures, I think, going forward.
Well, again, it's going to be very, very deceptive. As I've spoken a couple of different times, I mean, as President Trump is now deporting legal immigrants here. I repeat, legal immigrants. When you talk about temporary visa holders, they're legally here. As he begins the mass deportation of those folks, of which many have work permits, they're not going to show up in unemployment numbers. So that's why I have to look at the JOLTS, jobs openings report, try to figure what's going on here in the macro data, because the job openings report relationship is a reflection of whether or not there are jobs available. If the JOLTS keep going up in vacancies of jobs, generally that should mean higher unemployment. But if there's no higher employment, there's a data set problem, which I keep discovering economists and talking heads are misunderstanding because there's this now myth that he's deporting only undocumented. That is fiction. He has gone to Supreme Court and did get permission to deport temporary visa holders, of which they are workers. So this is going to be really messy because people get caught in the smoke screen of so much stuff going on here that it's hard to pinpoint what's happening. But the macro data is not going to make a lot of sense. I mean, ADP, which is not everybody, but I mean the payroll numbers were not growing, job openings are increasing. And people staying, more people taking unemployment, but unemployment overall doesn't shift, even though there's more people on unemployment. So when 3 out of 4 data sets say, claim that we're having going to have an increase in unemployment, but the big data set of unemployment isn't correct, they reflecting the other 3 data sets, there is a real problem here regarding what's going on in this country. And it's going to be one of those problems that you got to scratch your head regarding the data versus Main Street. How come the data says one thing, but Main Street's behaving another?
Yeah. There's a report that retail sales were down sharply. People cutting back because they basically stocked up before the tariffs hit.
You're right. And also, but consumer confidence went up again.
Yeah.
So retail sales are down, but the Chicago consumer confidence went up. Again, welcome to the data problem on the macro level. And this is something the Federal Reserve has to kind of reconcile over there too. They're trying to figure out what's really happening yesterday, much less trying to predict tomorrow, because I can't understand what happened yesterday because the data are in conflict.
Yeah, they're really caught in limbo, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, everyone's kind of in limbo, just trying to figure this out. I mean, COVID numbers were all insane because it was COVID. The macro data really was kind of bizarre. But
Right.
now you're getting to this, period of different type of economic uncertainty, but nothing's syncing up. Generally, they should move in tandem. So if consumer confidence is bad, consumer consumption also goes down. But that's not the case here. Consumer confidence went up, but consumption has gone down. It's
Yeah.
and with a service-based economy, it's like 70% of our economy is service-based. So consumption, because a U.S. consumer consumption is crucial, not necessarily just for U.S. businesses, but for the globe. U.S. consumes more stuff than any country on the planet, hence the trade deficit. The raw number and consumption of imports is higher than any country. We consume like the most of everything compared to other countries. And but it's not like it's, we're the only one. I mean, if another big economy country, let's say China, which has supposedly 600 and 800-ish middle class people, they're showing actually no consumption either, which means it's not just impacting domestic goods, but imports all import goods too, because people aren't inclined to buy import goods because they're going to be more expensive because of the tariff systems in place in both countries. So it's valid by domestic, but when domestic also is not picking up the slack, foreign goods brought into their country, the Chinese consumer is not spending, and then it's going to create a death spiral regarding the local economy. You saw that Japan, stagflation, right? That's 30 years of their economy. Argentina, opposite, hyperinflation, created stagnation in the economy. The two economies that never made any sense compared to the rest of the world. So, unemployment and recessionary fears are happening in Canada. The EU is not quite recessionary, but there is a slowdown. The British have unemployment rate going up. I mean, major economies around the world, that isn't us, is feeling a lot of economic pinch. However, as I always say over and over again in this podcast, the world moves on American money. I don't care what anybody says. We're the biggest consumers on the planet. If you're not consuming and I'm not consuming, it affects other businesses overseas, which then also create unemployment. That's how much influence we have as consumers. We can actually shift a country's local economy if we stop consuming.
Well, yeah, it's the old adage of all your eggs in one basket, right? That's why, because there is no other place to consume.
You can't replace the American consumer.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist. I mean, our per capita is almost $86,000, I believe. China's per capita can't get over 25,000.
Yeah, there's the disparity right there.
Yeah, volume doesn't compensate from sheer spending power of households. So you may have a bigger economy because the middle class is almost twice the size of the United States. And they have more people consuming. The problem is, even though they can do that, per capita is so low, the sheer volume of humans does not replace the insufficient money they have.
Right, the buying power that we have here, yeah.
Yeah, Europeans have actually a higher buying power, but they also have a lot of different mechanisms, not just domestic protection of industry, but also have different social services that keeps up their buying power. And smaller countries, meaning any country that's less than China, the United States, is very dependent on government spending as part of their economic mobility in terms of moving their economy. The US is actually one lower by percentage of GDP regarding economic stimulus from the federal government, which is under 20%. No, it's under 25% now. Other countries you see it's closer to 40%. In the case of Argentina, it's just like an 80 percentile. I mean, it's just
Is that
ridiculous.
right? Well,
You can't run an economy on government spending. It just can't happen. That was our game. When I say small economy, we're still talking trillions, but Texas and California is bigger than most countries on the planet by themselves in GDP. So it's really not as simple because Americans have a bad habit of comparing us to everybody else, and it's no comparison. It's not even close where we're closing a $30 trillion GDP. We're skyrocketing there quickly. China's a stagnant 19-ish, 20-ish, depending whose number you use. But then you go to like a deep drop to like Germany and Japan, where they're floating at $5-ish trillion. I mean, how do you compare, our economy that's six times bigger than number three and number four? And I think this is something that people in this country just don't understand. It's like, we are the biggest. And we are able to influence economies by you choosing to spend or not spend your US dollars on whatever you're doing at home. The Trump administration has a bad habit also telling everybody that like we're on equal footing, that they're taking advantage of us. I get the statement. The macro data kind of gives the indication, but he overlooks one simple fact is that the US lives to is the biggest consumer on the planet. It's just that simple. So, it is not equal footing. We're always going to have the advantage, no matter what happens on a global level.
Yeah, and there's always going to be somewhat of a deficit. It can't be equal. The numbers wouldn't allow it based on those facts.
Well, that's an interesting question, right? Is deficits bad? The answer is depending who asks, whose economist asks. So it'll give you
Yeah.
kind of the contradicting point of view, right? On the one front, deficits are bad because the US dollar is strong because the US consumer is spending a lot of money. So the more US dollars you spend on foreign goods, the more US dollars is the dominant currency on the planet because people action US good US dollars because we move everyone's economies forward. So then you have a deficit, but it creates a situation where everyone's super dependent on the US dollar. Like even though people are de-risking the US dollar globally with the Europeans moving to euro in particular, but if you look at the global level, it's like 70 plus over 70 plus of all transactions are played as US dollars. Why? Because we buy the most. Results tend to be a stronger dollar, but the US currency is pretty much acceptable anywhere on the planet regarding commercial transaction.
Right.
First, it's easy to convert US dollars to local currency. And some places will just take the US dollar, and other
Oh
countries,
yeah.
they just take the dollars.
Yeah.
They'll do the conversion themselves. And
Right.
then,
It's worth it for them. Right. Yeah.
exactly. And then most of the planet is pegged to US dollars. So whatever their economy is, their GDP is so weak or just so small, it's actually easy for them to peg themselves to US dollar because the US is the highest transaction fee in the world. Why? Because we consume the most. It isn't complicated on that front. On the flip side, right, the surplus creates a problem because it affects domestic jobs. However, manufacturing jobs are hard to bring back. We're a service-based industry now. We sell intelligence, for lack of a better term, and we sell services. But we do sell specific kind of specialized goods that other countries aren't either well-educated or have good enough infrastructure to deal with, unless you're Japan, China, Taiwan, Korea, Japan. I mean, unless you're, I mean, Germany, England. I mean, you have to be one of those really first-world countries. But most countries do not have the specialty or intelligence or well, not intelligence. That's not the right word. I mean, the education and the technology to allow them to do certain things like big pharma and things like that, and complex machinery, airplane parts, and so forth. So the deficit is bad because it affects domestic jobs and our ability to export because of the US dollar, because now our stuff costs more expensive, but the other side doesn't have as much money. So how they can buy the stuff if they don't have enough money?
Right.
But their economy is driven by not solely the United States, but the US is a big part of many economies regarding consumption of their goods, which means they stay economically viable. This has always been the irony of the policy of Ludwig. It's like we want people to buy more stuff, but we want you to send us less stuff. But then, how can you buy our stuff if we pull McDonald's out of your country as a major employer?
Right. It's catch 22, exactly.
We saw that in Russia. When the Russia-Ukraine war came out, a lot of European countries and US businesses all yanked themselves out of Russia. A McDonald's alone, I think, it was like 6,000 plus jobs by
All right.
themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when IKEA, even IKEA, which is not a like a huge company, but I mean, they had created gaps of thousands of jobs because of the spill-off effect when business creates economic development in this area. So, I mean, Russia unemployment skyrocketed, which is why the government intervened and, arranged to have one of the oligarchs buy, all at the McDonald's and rebranded it from McDonald's so they can keep the jobs in place. I mean, the U.S. can make you really poor if the U.S. investment goes away.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch from an economic level for sure, the way the impact hits different countries.
Well, I mean, we have a real life example. I mean, again, we all have short memories, but we have it was called Russia, right? At where the Ukraine war started, ignore the ruble and that kind of crazy action. The volume of jobs that were decapitated by U.S. investment leaving Russia was enormous, and only the only reason they're able to maintain it was because the government literally stepped in and took them all over and gave it to an oligarch to run that business. So, I mean, there's already a real life example of what happens when you pull all U.S. money out of a country.
Back here at home, still in budget talks, I'm guessing, at the State House.
Yeah, the conference committee is still going. Fiscal year ends June 30th, as we talk about every year, as long as our budget situation is stable. I fully expect that we normally do. We tend to miss our deadline. I mean, it's almost like you accept it now. But if this budget situation is stable here, we can go over a bit. But depending on how to get this done in the next 30 odd days, I mean, we may end up doing overrides in September as opposed to trying to do them before the end of July. As you all aware, the rules debate continues in Conference Committee and creates some trying to figure out how this is going to play out as chairs because it's not like I'm privy to the conversations. I'm subject to the news service like everyone else on that kind of thing. But it also impacts how chairs are going to operate. So stay tuned. We'll see how this plays out. But I expect the next 30 days, a budget will come forward. And again, I'm not exactly the most positive person, but I don't see a doom and gloom scenario yet. However, we'll see how Congress behaves. I mean, the U.S. House formalized largely so-called DOGE cuts, which we'll see if it actually will get through the Senate. And of course, this massive tax package and spending, that's why it's referred to as a budget bill, that Senate just released, really decapitates certain clean energy sectors and EVs, which will have a big impact, but it's going to impact most, believe it or not, Republican states that were looking for manufacturing. Solar panels are being built in South Carolina, not exactly a Democratic state. So we'll see how that plays out, where you have at least a half dozen states that are Republican states directly benefit from manufacturing associated with renewable power. Ironic is that you have Republicans who stay advocating against renewable power, but it's become the economic engine for them.
Yes. When it hits home, all politics is local.
It is, and then but there's always this dichotomy of political philosophy I find fascinating, particularly in the new structure of both political parties' thought. And the Republican Party is kind of fascinating in the sense that those states do have like an anti-renewable tint, but those states actually are now dependent on federal money to create modern manufacturing, which is building solar panels, wind turbines, generators, and things like that, which is the future for the next basically 50 years. So those are going to be steady manufacturing jobs that Biden administration wanted to bring back, and he started doing it. The Trump administration wants to bring back manufacturing too, but he wants to bring back manufacturing that requires enormously cheap labor and low education levels, as opposed to going after things that we can compete better in, that requires higher education levels, better technical training, better vocational training, and requires the already pre-existing technology in your own country to actually move that forward, as opposed to building infrastructure. Again, I get that we're living in this kind of world of political philosophy. I just don't understand.
Well, stay tuned for sure. Things are changing quickly.
Well, if you go to South Carolina and you ask the Republican Party, are you for renewables? And I suspect the answer would be no, but what would that solar manufacturing plant? Then they have a seizure.
It's you want it both ways and you can't.
They can't reconcile their political philosophy correctly with the practical world of the states. And that's why I'm really, really like baffled by all this. And it's finally come to a head because state and Republican senators, elected congressmen, are now having conniptious in the Senate on these subsidies that are being taken away, because those businesses are either going to have to shrink the size of the manufacturing, or perhaps move back to China, or perhaps
Yes.
move to China for the first time, depending on circumstances.
Right. Yep. That'll be interesting for sure. We are at the end of our hour, believe it or not.
Yeah, time flies when you're having fun talking about everything from the Flag Day parade to geopolitics in the Middle East to
Right.
budget to unemployment numbers to the dichotomy of unreconcilable political philosophies and political parties. We'll go about Democrats next time if you want, about some
Yeah, let's do that. Okay, that's good.
national, about the national philosophy. So I really have problems with my head reconciling.
Okay, good. We'll do that for sure. Meantime, how to get a hold of you?
617-722-2370, 617-722-2370 is the office number. It is not my office. Work through the prompts and just hit one of the people on my staff. We'll get the message somehow. Tacky.chan@mahouse.gov, tackey.chan@mahouse.gov. I do check my emails, and for about 3 weeks, I was averaging like 150 to 200 emails a day, which was mind-boggling difficult regarding people's testimony to the committee. But I do check it, and we do prioritize constituent services first. It's not like I don't see it all, but I do. I just whether I can remember the names is another matter. We do have at Tacky Chan on X, and we have State Representative Tacky Chan on Facebook. One of my friends noted, "You have more Facebook activity." I'm like, "Yes, things are getting busier. You can see me around." And then, Statehouse 142, please do visit. I love people visiting the Statehouse to take the tours. And we had, as you said, school ended today. So, if people are looking for something to do that doesn't cost you any money to take a tour, definitely come visit the State House. We have tackychin.org, which is a resource contact page, as well as malegislature.gov. I encourage people to look at the state legislature website before calling me, because you can find everything you need there regarding bills. And obviously, me and Joe here on QATV every week or 2 weeks. And I also want to close out by congratulate the Atherton Howe School on naming one of the new MBTA ferries, Abigail Adams.
Yes, little Haley Summers won that contest. So congratulations to her and her family. That's great.
Yeah, and she had the honor of christening the Abigail Adams as the person who put forward the name for the name of the boat. And we had a wonderful christening ceremony yesterday, despite the cloudy weather. Those I repeat over and over again, and I don't like boats, I don't like water. So there is a picture of me on there in the Quincy Sun this week, I suspect, which and Channel 5 had had us Quincy folks front and center first shot. So you have now seen me on a boat. And it'll probably be another many, many years until you see that a second time. But there is photo.
It wasn't moving though.
No, it wasn't moving. There's photographic and video evidence of this now. But I was
Okay.
But no, very much congratulations to Scoo and Haley, on this. And Abigail is riding the waves around Boston. And as we say, we remember a lot of struggle figures, but Abigail Adams was a key figure in the American Revolution and founding this country. Healthy debate with your husband is not a bad
That's right. Yeah, definitely a founding mother for sure.
thing. Very easily.
Thanks a lot, Jackie.
Take care, Joe.